Welcome to 2 and 2 Yesterday, broadcasting shows from the golden age of radio. I'm your host, Mark the Vanier. And in this hour, crime shows. Later on, a well-known broadcast of suspense starring Fred McMurray. But right now, it's The Judge. Not too much is known about this series, which was first heard on June 5th, 1952 on CBS, and this seems to be the only recording that has survived. John Daner is the star, along with Georgia Ellis, Vivi Janis, Byron Kane, under the direction of Norman McDonald.
I am Judge A.J. Adams. For almost 40 years, I presided over one of the highest criminal courts in the land, and I have learned, above all, that no crime is perfect. The Judge. Each week at this time, Judge A.J. Adams solves another nearly perfect crime. Relying on the fact that mistakes are repeated, that criminal motives do not vary, the judge, now retired, draws upon his vast courtroom experience to fight another battle for justice. It is evening just outside the palatial home of Mrs. Agatha Winters, one of the town's wealthiest widows. Mrs. Winters lives with her stepson Ronald and her secretary Catherine Shaw. A high solid brick wall surrounds the Winters estate, cutting it off from the rest of the neighborhood. It's 9:30 when a long sleek convertible pulls up the driveway in front of the mansion and stops. The car door opens, a young man steps out. He starts up the stairs toward the house as a voice from out of the shadows says...
Ronnie!
What?
Ronnie, wait.
Julie, what are you doing here?
I had to talk to you. Ronnie, why haven't you been to the nightclub to see me? It's been almost a week.
I've told you, Julie, it's no use.
Ronnie, have you forgotten? We were going to be married.
Now, you're only making this more difficult. I'm sorry if I sound brutal, but there's no other way.
But, Ronnie, you can't end this.
Good night, Julie. Or perhaps I should say goodbye.
Ronnie! Ronnie! Ronnie?
Oh, hello, Catherine. Is my stepmother still up?
No, she's retired for the evening.
Oh. Well, I have some news for her. She won't have to worry about Julie Young anymore.
I know she'll be pleased to hear that. Your stepmother did worry, so...
Yes, I'm sure she did. Good night, Catherine.
Good night, Ronnie.
It's good to be home. It's stuffy in this room. I'll just open the window. It's a beautiful night. Hello. Looks as though there's someone down in the garden. Who's there? Who's... Oh, it's you. Hey, wait. Put down that...
It is 30 minutes later. Not many miles away, sitting in his study, is Judge A.J. Adams. Once one of the nation's most fearless fighters against crime... Judge Adams is now retired. However, from time to time, the good judge is pleased to lend his brilliant judicial mind to the cause of justice when called upon by the police. Now the telephone just outside Judge Adams' study rings suddenly. A short, plump woman of about 50 wipes her hands on her apron and walks towards the phone. She is Mrs. Maloney, Judge Adams' faithful housekeeper. She lifts the receiver.
Judge Adams' residence.
Mrs. Maloney, this is Lieutenant Tommy Ross of the police department.
Oh.
I wonder if I could disturb the judge for a moment.
Well, he's resting in his study, Lieutenant. Can it not wait till the morning?
I'm afraid it can't, Mrs. Maloney. This time it's really important. Would you call him to the phone?
Well, seeing as how you're an old friend, Lieutenant, but next time...
Mrs. Maloney.
I'll get him right away. It's them police again, Judge, bothering you at all hours.
Oh, yes, Mrs. Maloney. I'll take it on this extension. Judge Adams speaking.
Hello, Judge. This is Tommy Ross.
Well, hello, Tommy. What can I do for you?
Judge, Does the name Agatha Winters register with you?
Oh, indeed it does. Mrs. Winters represents one of our very prominent families. In fact, she is the leader of the reform movement in the coming city elections.
Exactly, Judge. Mrs. Agatha Winters is chairman of the Citizens Committee Against Crime.
Yes.
Right now, she's a murder suspect.
She what?
If this thing breaks in the newspapers, it'll blow the lid off City Hall.
Now, Tommy, suppose you try being a little more explicit.
Judge, I called to ask if you'd mind coming over to the Winters' home right away. I could use your help. You see, Mrs. Agatha Winters' stepson, Ronnie, has just been murdered. Here you are, Judge Adams.
Yeah, I'm sorry I took so long, Tommy. The old car doesn't start as easily as it used to.
Judge, perhaps we could talk in the library.
You are the policeman, Lieutenant.
Yeah. Now, about 45 minutes ago, Ronnie Winters was shot through the heart. As best we can tell, he was standing at the window of his bedroom upstairs when it happened. There were no powder burns on the body. And from the angle of the wound, it's our opinion young Winters was shot from the garden below.
He was at home alone?
Oh, no. Now, there were two other people in the house. His stepmother, Mrs. Winters, and her secretary, Catherine Shaw. Now, Mrs. Winters claims she was in bed asleep at the time. And Catherine Shaw tells me she was in the kitchen making some coffee.
Well, then neither can alibi for the other.
Right, Judge.
Tommy, what about the murder weapon?
I was afraid you were going to ask me that.
Oh?
It can't be found. I've got 10 men on this case, Judge. They've searched every inch of the grounds and the house. The gun that killed Ronnie Winters has disappeared.
I see. Now, tell me, Tommy, who telephoned the police?
Mrs. Winters. She says she was awakened by the shots and called us immediately.
Yeah.
And luckily, there was a squad car patrolling only two blocks away. They arrived here within minutes after the shooting.
Then there is an excellent chance that the murderer at this moment is on the Winters estate.
All right, Judge. Neither Mrs. Winters nor Miss Shaw heard a car leave after the shooting, and the grounds around this mansion cover almost 5 acres. Also, I've got 4 squad cars patrolling the area bordering the Winters' home. No one has been seen leaving the estate.
Well, Lieutenant Ross, I must say you are doing a thorough job.
Coming from you, Judge Adams, that means something. Now, there's just one more thing.
Yes, Tommy?
If the newspapers get wind of this murder, they're going to spread the Winters family all over the front page, Judge. You know what that'll do to this town's reform movement.
Well, with Mrs. Winters a murder suspect, I should imagine it would be a severe blow.
Well, that's why I called you, Judge. We're working against time.
Tommy, this matter affects our entire community. You'll come along now. I think we better have another chat with Miss Shaw and Mrs. Winters.
There's Catherine Shaw coming out of Mrs. Winters' room now, Judge.
Good. Perhaps Miss Shaw can talk to us.
Yeah. Oh, Miss Shaw...
Yes, Lieutenant Ross.
I would like you to meet Judge A.J. Adams.
Oh, I'm deeply honored, Judge Adams.
How do you do, Miss Shaw?
I've read a great deal about your work with the police.
Well, thank you, Miss Shaw. Well, I see right now that you are reading Emile Zola's fascinating book, The Human Beast.
I think it's one of Zola's best works, Judge Adams.
Miss Shaw, I wonder if I might speak with you for a few moments.
Why, of course.
Did you discover the body of Ronald Winters?
Yes, sir. I was in the kitchen when I heard the shots. I ran upstairs immediately and found Ronnie lying there beneath the windowsill.
And Mrs. Winters, when did she arrive?
Just a few moments later. She was awakened out of a sound sleep.
Miss Shaw, I'm going to ask you a very important question, and I must have a completely frank answer.
I'll be glad to answer, Judge Adams.
Thank you. Did Mrs. Winters and her stepson get along well?
Most of the time, yes, sir.
But some of the time, they did not.
Well, there was one minor matter.
Please, continue.
Ronnie was going with a nightclub singer, Julie Young. Mrs. Winters didn't approve. She asked Ronnie to stop seeing the girl.
And did he?
Well, there was a scene. At first, Ronnie refused, then... Then when Mrs. Winters said she wouldn't let Ronnie disgrace the family name, she said...
Go on.
She'd rather see him dead.
Miss Shaw, why haven't you revealed this information to the police?
Lieutenant, Mrs. Winters is not only my employer, she's my close personal friend. I'd hate to see her involved.
Miss Shaw, that's for the police to decide.
Lieutenant Ross is quite correct, but I understand your loyalty. Now, Miss Shaw, tell me, did you know Julie Young?
Well, I've never met her. However, tonight when Ronnie came in, he told me he'd broken off with the girl.
I checked on this Julie Young, Judge. She works at the Bluebird Cafe. That's a night spot on the other side of town.
Miss Shaw, do either you or Mrs. Winters own a gun?
Oh, no, Judge. We've never had one in the house.
How long have you lived in this house with Mrs. Winters?
Almost 4 years, since Mrs. Winters' husband died.
Thank you, Miss Shaw. You've been most cooperative.
Anything I can do to help, Judge Adams. Anything at all.
I shall be happy to call on you.
Oh, keeps going in circles, Judge. And still no sign of the murder weapon.
Tommy, regarding this Miss Julie Young...
Yes, sir?
I think you'd better send for her right away. Meanwhile, I'm going to have a talk with Mrs. Agatha Winters.
And he was there, beneath the windowsill, Ronnie, dead.
Now, there, Mrs. Winters, please... Try to calm yourself.
Oh, I'm so glad you're here, Judge Adams. I know you'll help us.
Well, I shall try my best. Mrs. Winters, exactly what were the terms of your late husband's will?
I'm afraid I can't recall the terms of his will.
To whom did the bulk of the estate go?
To Ronnie. Oh, poor Ronnie.
And he received his inheritance 4 years ago?
No. No, it was held in trust until his 25th birthday. I was named executor of the estate until then.
And when would Ronald have become 25?
On Thursday. Just 3 days from now.
And if he died before his birthday, you retained control of the estate, hmm?
Well, yes.
Thank you, Mrs. Winters. I hope it won't be necessary to trouble you again.
Oh, please, Judge Adams, please help the police to find the person who killed my son.
Your stepson, Mrs. Winters.
Yes, my step... Judge, you don't think that I...
Mrs. Winters, I shall do everything in my power to see that the murderer of Ronald Winters is apprehended.
Oh, Judge, I have to talk to you.
Yes, Tommy.
I sent a squad car down to the Bluebird nightclub to pick up Julie Young.
And?
The men just got back. The manager of the Bluebird told them Julie Young disappeared at 9 o'clock. She hasn't been seen since.
How about her residence?
We checked there. They said she left sometime this afternoon, hasn't been back. Besides that, she was due at the Bluebird for the 9:30 show.
9:30?
Yes.
Approximately the time of the murder of Ronald Winters. Tommy, why don't you and I take a stroll outside? I'd like to look over the grounds.
Right, Judge. I've doubled the men searching out there. Somewhere in these 5 acres, we're going to find that gun. And when we do, it's my guess we'll find the murderer still holding it.
Well, Lieutenant Ross, it appears you have half the city's police force searching for one gun.
Oh, I'd have more if they weren't needed elsewhere.
Yes.
Judge, this case has got to be cracked, and soon. We can't hold the reporters off much longer.
Yes, sir, I know.
Every racketeer in this town would like nothing better than a scandal involving Mrs. Winters, the reform leader.
Hold it. Tommy, I believe one of your men has discovered something.
Ah.
All right. Come out of those bushes with your hands up.
Judge, someone hiding in the shrubs. Yeah. You better get back in the house. They could be shooting.
If there is, you'll need every man of us.
I'm going to count three. If you aren't out of there with your hands up, we open fire. One. Two.
No.
Judge, it's a girl.
She's coming this way, Tommy.
Don't shoot, please. Don't shoot, Johnny.
Now, well, young lady.
Hold your fire, man.
Judge, are you okay? She ran right into you.
Luckily, I'm in better shape than most men my age.
All right, now, miss, suppose you tell us your name.
No, she's frightened, Tommy. Let me try it. Come here. Miss?
Yes?
Who are you?
My name is Julie Young.
Julie Young, the nightclub singer.
Please, couldn't we go inside?
We'll do better than that, Miss Young. I'm arresting you for the murder of Ronnie Winters.
Well,
right, Miss Young. If you're as innocent as you say you are, why were you discovered just a few minutes ago hiding on the Winters estate?
I was afraid.
Afraid of what?
Well, after I left Ronnie earlier tonight, I heard shots. I ran down the driveway, and then suddenly there were headlights coming toward me, and I hid in the shrubs. When the car passed, I saw it was the police. I was too frightened to move.
Miss Young.
Yes, Judge.
Would you please describe the scene that took place between you and Ronald Winters earlier this evening?
I came to the house to see Ronnie. Yes? It was about 9:30, I guess. Just as I arrived, he drove up in his car. I asked him why he hadn't come to the club to see me. And he said it was all over between us. He left me standing there, and he went in the house.
And you're asking us to believe that after being jilted by Ronnie Winters, you turned meekly and walked away?
It's true, Lieutenant. I swear it. I wouldn't have killed Ronnie, no matter what he did. I loved him.
Okay, okay.
I loved him.
Sanders, take her in the other room.
Come along, miss. Come along.
Well, Judge, I'm licked. None of these people killed Ronnie Winters, but he's dead.
You know, Tommy, it's entirely possible Julie Young is telling the truth.
Well, Judge, she's sincere, she's innocent-looking, but she had the perfect motive. And furthermore, she was found hiding on the ground.
If Julie Young murdered young Winters, wouldn't the gun have been found either on her person or somewhere on the grounds?
Well, now, Judge, do you realize I've got more than 20 policemen on this case now? And every single one of them are looking for a small hunk of metal, a gun. The gun that killed Ronnie Winters.
Now, easy, Tommy, my boy. I realize this is an extremely unusual case, but I assure you there is some logical explanation.
Oh, yeah? But where do we find it?
I recall a case of some years back during which the solution hinged upon the finding of the murder weapon. I believe I have the history of that case at home in my study.
Now, what has a case years ago got to do with the murder of Ronnie Winters tonight?
Tommy, it is my opinion that there is very little new under the sun, and that includes murder. For each criminal investigation, there is one in the record books that has many similar factors. You might even say that it is upon this premise that our system of law is based. That is why lawyers and judges alike so often refer to older cases during a trial.
Okay, Judge, okay, so somebody else once had trouble finding a gun. Where does that leave us?
With your permission, Lieutenant, I would like to return to my home and study my law books. I believe something vital will come of it.
I'll do better than that, Judge Adams. I'll give you a squad car and two men to help you. But let me warn you in advance, Judge. I've got my murderer, and her name is Julie Young.
So, you finally came home, Judge Adams.
Why, Mrs. Maloney, perhaps I might ask what my housekeeper is doing up at this hour of the night?
Keeping track of you, that's what. And where is your hat?
I beg your pardon?
Judge, I said, where is your hat? Do you want to catch your death on such a cold night?
Mrs. Maloney, if you'll excuse me, I have an urgent matter.
Urgent enough? 'Tis about time you got some sense in your head. Staying up to all hours and going bareheaded in this weather.
Here,
Judge Adams. You may be very intelligent, like them policemen and newspapers is always saying, but to me, you're just a man who needs taken care of. No hat, indeed.
Good night, Mrs. Maloney. In the future, I shall check with you regarding my haberdashery. Now, let me see. Where is that book? Yes, here's the volume I need. Yes, it's just the case I had in mind. The State of Illinois versus Cartwright. Why, yes, of course. A very important point. What now, Mrs. Maloney?
It's a telephone for you, Judge. Lieutenant Ross. And he says it's very urgent.
All right, Mrs. Maloney, thank you. Yes?
Judge, Tommy Ross.
Yes?
You better come back to the Winters' home right away.
Is something wrong, Tommy?
It's that Julie Young dame. She was a bundle of nerves, Judge, so I let her lie down in a spare bedroom.
Go on.
Well, I used my sympathy instead of my head. Julie Young has escaped.
He what? I'll be right there.
soup. The reporters are outside screaming for blood, and my number one suspect just flew the coop.
Easy, Tommy. She couldn't have gotten very far.
Oh, I suppose you're right, Judge. I've got every man searching the grounds for her. But so far as I'm concerned, this proves it. Just as soon as Julie Young is recaptured, she's getting a nice, cozy cell.
Tommy, I wonder if I could ask one more favor of you.
Oh, Judge, it's getting late. Oh, well, for you, sure. Go ahead.
Thank you, Tommy. Could you have your men bring Mrs. Winters and Miss Shaw into the library now? I'm sure you will find it highly informative.
I'm going to have to ask you, Mrs. Winters and Miss Shaw, to give Judge Adams your complete cooperation. All right, Judge, the floor is yours.
Thank you. From the very beginning of this case, certain factors seemed familiar to me. Primarily the matter of the missing weapon. Thanks to the kindness of Lieutenant Ross, I was able to return to my study and engage in some research. That research has borne fruit.
Judge, oh, Judge, please, have you discovered who killed my stepson?
In a moment, Mrs. Winters. The basic problem in a murder case is generally the motive. But in this case, there were many motives available. Mrs. Winters.
Yes, Judge Adams.
By your own admission, your husband's vast estate would have been turned over to your stepson in but 3 days, had he lived.
That's true, Judge, but you certainly don't think that
please. In addition, there is the known fact that you informed your stepson, Ronald, that you would prefer to see him dead rather than disgrace the family name. Is that not correct?
Well, yes.
Motive and circumstantial evidence. Now, Miss Shaw.
Yes, sir.
I believe you stated you had been in Mrs. Winters' employ for 4 years.
That's true, Judge.
And during that time, you have served her faithfully. In fact, have become more her companion than secretary.
Well, yes, I suppose so.
Thank you. With Ronald Winters now dead, a new will is in effect. Yours, Mrs. Winters. With no children of your own, could you please tell me how you have planned to distribute your estate?
Well, a great part of it is to go to charity.
And the remainder?
To Catherine Shaw.
Did Miss Shaw know that?
Well, yes, Judge. I told Catherine I'd take care of her for the rest of her life.
In other words, a strong motive for Miss Shaw. If you, Mrs. Winters, were convicted of the murder of your stepson, Catherine Shaw would inherit the entire fortune.
Judge Adams, I didn't kill Ronnie.
Yes?
Lieutenant Ross, I've got Julie Young.
Julie Young? Bring her in, Sanders. Well, Miss Young, I imagine you're ready to sign a statement now.
I had to run. You made everything point to me, but I didn't kill Ronnie.
Judge Adams, okay, if we bust up this little gathering now, we've got the guilty party.
I'm afraid I can't agree with you, Tommy.
What?
If you'll give me another minute, I'm sure you will understand why.
Okay. Okay, Judge, another minute.
Now we have the motives established for three people. Miss Young here, the scorned lover. Mrs. Winters, facing what she felt to be family disgrace and loss of control of the family money. And Miss Shaw, also a matter of large inheritance. But what of the murder weapon? 20 policemen have covered this entire estate, have searched this home from attic to cellar. The gun is still missing.
It's no use, Judge. We've covered every inch of the grounds.
Yes, and very efficiently, too, Tommy. That is why I wanted to check my law books. And it was while studying the case of the state of Illinois versus Cartwright that I found my answer.
Answer, Judge?
Exactly. In the Cartwright case, as in this one, during the entire investigation, the murderer concealed the weapon on his person.
Oh, but Judge, all these people were searched.
Well, I'm sure they were, Tommy. Nonetheless, in this room, right now, we have a murderer carrying the gun that killed Ronald Winters. Miss Shaw.
Yes, Judge Adams.
Do you enjoy reading Emile Zola's novel, The Human Beast?
Why, of course.
You do?
You asked me that once before.
Well, would you tell me about the book, please?
Well, it's about a Frenchman who was a human beast.
Very interesting, Miss Shaw. You've enjoyed reading the book so much that you do not know the human beast described by Zola is actually a locomotive and not a man at all.
Locomotive?
You have enjoyed the book so much you have carried it in your right hand since the moment Ronald Winters was murdered.
All right, Judge. You're right. I've got the gun. Here.
The gun that killed Ronnie.
Catherine, the gun was inside your book.
By carefully cutting out the pages of this large novel, Miss Catherine Shaw has been able to conceal the gun with which she killed Ronald Winters. That book and the murder weapon never left her person.
And I still have it in my right hand, ladies and gentlemen. Only I won't need this book anymore. All right, Lieutenant Ross. Call off your men. I'm leaving this house and no one dares stop me.
You see, Tommy, a book may conceal a dangerous weapon, just as darkness conceals an attack.
Right, Judge?
Don't move or I'll shoot!
And since this light switch is near my hand...
Turn off those lights!
Quick, Tommy.
Right, Judge? Grab her! Stop that now.
I'll get the lights.
Oh, let go of me!
I've got a judge.
Good work, Tommy. Well, Miss Shaw, yours was a diabolical plot. You killed Ronald Winters and hoped Mrs. Winters would be executed for the crime so that you would inherit a large portion of the estate. Ah, take her away.
Yes, Sanders, take her out of here.
Come along, you. Come along.
Oh, Judge Adams, I don't know how to thank you.
Well, Judge, as usual, I owe you more than I can tell.
Oh. Nonsense, Tommy. We merely used a stuffy old law book to help us solve a difficult riddle.
Oh, no, not we, Judge Adams, you. I'm sure Mrs. Winters and all the others in the reform movement won't forget your brilliant work in solving this crime.
Tommy, Chief Justice Holmes of the Supreme Court once taught me that every criminal makes the initial mistake of believing he has discovered a new way to beat the law. Yet, like Catherine Shaw, they too must learn any way to crime will end in prison.
The Judge, under the direction of Norman MacDonald, stars John Daner and is written by Richard Petticini and William Frug.
The Judge, on Tuned to Yesterday from June 5th, 1952 on CBS. It's an hour of crime on Tuned to Yesterday. I'm your host, Mark LeVonier. And now we bring you Suspense with the story of the Great Train Robbery, starring Joseph Kearns and Fred McMurray. And this broadcast from CBS first heard on April 13th, 1953.
And now, Autolite presents transcribed The Great Train Robbery, starring Mr. Fred McMurray, hoping once again to keep you in suspense.
My name is Walter Beaumont. I'm 42 years old. I have no prominent marks or features that would distinguish me from any other plain, ordinary citizen. I live with my wife, Bess, in Oakland. If you saw me walking down the street, you wouldn't give me a second glance. The details of my appearance are very important. You see, they're what convinced me that I could execute a great train robbery. Bess and I have been married for 16 long and uneventful years. The year before we were married, I went to work for a toy manufacturing firm. I've been down there ever since and am now making $62 a week. 16 years ago, I had a lot of dreams and some ambition. But the necessities and responsibilities of our everyday living have cost me most of those dreams and what little ambition I had.
Walter, did you remember to pay the rent?
Yes, Bess.
Installment on the washing machine?
Uh-huh.
What about the payment on the car and the box spring and mattress?
Those too, Bess.
Oh, wished we had a little money left over. At least enough to buy you a new white shirt. I've already turned the collars on the only three you own. Well, maybe we can get you one next month, if we're lucky.
If we're lucky. For 16 years, it's been the same thing, over and over again. A new white shirt, if we're lucky. A new pair of hose, if we're lucky. The same thing, it never changes. Each night at 5:30, I drive up and park in front of a tarnished white stucco house where we've lived for the last 8 years, and I know that nothing has changed. But tonight when I got home, there was a change, a happy change, some relief, a new face, the face of a visiting long-lost relative, Cousin Eugene.
Yes, sirree, Cousin Bess, that's just about the best meal I've had in a long, long time.
Well, I'm glad you like it, Eugene.
One of these days, we'll have you over for a real feast, Eugene.
As soon as Walter's ship comes in.
Oh, I'm a plain man. The simple things in life are good enough for me.
Not for Walter. He's got ideas high and mighty.
No. No, not anymore.
He's got a dream world all his own.
Well, Cousin Bess, we all do a little dreaming now and then. Cigar, Cousin Walter?
Oh, yes, thanks. Thanks, Eugene.
Here's a light.
That tastes good.
Yeah. There's nothing like a cigar after dinner, say I. It's the finishing touch.
Do you have any definite plans for the future, Eugene?
Well, Walter, I think I'm just about ready to settle down.
Well, that's good to hear.
I'd like to buy me a farm somewheres and maybe raise some chickens. Always did like chickens.
You know, I think I would have done something like that one day if...
Go ahead, Walter. Say it. If you'd ever had the money.
Well, that's my problem, folks. Money. You got to have money to buy a farm, and right now I don't have any.
Well, that's a shame.
Say, speaking of money, you ever been up to Reno, Nevada, Walter?
No, I've never been there.
We don't get to go to too many places, Eugene. Seems like we always have something else more important to do with Walter's vacation money.
Well, you've never seen so much money in all your life as there is in Reno.
I'll bet it's an exciting town, all right?
Oh, it is. Just about one of the most exciting towns I've ever been in. Yes, sirree. Lots of excitement. Lots of money.
I guess our type of people would never get up to a city like Reno.
Oh, I wouldn't say that, Cousin Walter. They get all types of people up in a city like Reno, all types. You see, people figure there's money to be had there, and money attracts all kinds of people.
I often wondered what Walter'd do if he had a lot of money.
He'd be an interesting man to watch.
Him and all his dreams.
Yeah, they have all types up there. Rich man, poor man, beggar man, thief.
What did you say, Eugene?
I said rich man, poor man, beggar man, thief.
Yes, that's what I thought you said. And then Cousin Eugene gave me one of those long, lingering, meaningful looks. Then he leaned back in his chair, smiled, inhaled deeply on his cigar, blew the smoke out in a thin stream and watched it as it fanned up toward the ceiling. Eugene had made some kind of a decision, and it concerned me. It concerned me very much. The following morning, about 11:30, Eugene called me at the office. He told me he wanted to see me on my lunch hour. He said he had something very important that he wanted to talk over with me, and could I meet him? I met him at 12:05 in front of the ferry terminal. It's not too long a ferry boat ride over to Richmond, and I figured I could be back to work on time. I'll just eat my lunch while you go ahead and talk, Eugene. Is that all right?
Oh, sure. Go right ahead, Cousin Walter. Bess fix your lunch every day?
Oh, yeah. Every day. As far back as I can remember. You'd be surprised how much money it saves.
Mm-hmm. Walter, what would you do if I gave you one half of, say, $25,000?
Excuse me, For a minute, I thought you said $25,000.
I did?
What are you talking about, Eugene?
Well, you're a dreamer, so am I. There's only one way to make our dreams come true. We have to buy them, Cousin Walter, with money. That's why I've picked you.
Picked me?
Last night at the dinner table, I said there was a lot of money in Reno, Nevada.
That's right, you did.
Now, some of this money stays in Reno, and some of it goes elsewhere. Do you follow me?
No, not quite.
Well, some of it goes to banks, like banks here in Oakland and San Francisco.
Oh, I see what you mean.
Now, how does it get to these banks? Well, some of it they drive, some of it they fly, and some of it they load on the mail car of a train. Do you follow me?
Go ahead, Eugene. Go ahead.
The train they load it on leaves the city of Reno every Thursday morning at 11 o'clock. It arrives in San Francisco at 4:30 in the afternoon. Do you follow me now?
Yes.
After the train leaves Reno, it passes through a place called Soda Springs at 1:50. Then there follows a stretch of about 20 minutes before it passes a place called Dutch Flat, a stretch of nothing but lonely, dry desert.
Go on, Eugene.
And
go on.
If one gentleman was to get on the train in Reno and another gentleman was to drive a car to a deserted junction in between Soda Springs and Dutch Flat...
The train could be stopped, the money taken off, and the gentlemen well on their way before the authorities could be warned.
Why, Cousin Walter, do you realize what you've just suggested?
Yes. Yes, Eugene, I've just suggested that we rob a train. The ferry boat pulled into the Richmond Landing and Eugene got off. As he stepped down the gangplank, he turned around, smiled, and waved at me and disappeared into the crowd. The following day at work, I had a hard time trying to concentrate on a new shipment of toy atomic tanks we'd gotten in. And right after lunch, the phone on my desk began to ring. I let it ring a couple of times. I was almost afraid to pick it up, afraid that it might not be Eugene. Hello?
Hello, Cousin Walter?
Yes.
Done much thinking about that matter we discussed?
Yes, I have. But, Eugene, I was thinking, how can just the two of us...
Oh, it's very simple. I've worked for weeks on this plan. You must have complete faith in me.
Oh, I do, Eugene, I do. But what about Bess? How will I explain it to her?
Oh, now you just leave that to me.
Yes, but eventually I'm going to...
Eventually you can tell her. And, Cousin Walter...
Yes?
What's more, I know she'll understand.
So it begins. It's the kind of a thrill that comes once in a lifetime. When I was just a small boy, I had play-acted it out many times, but now it was a reality. I was going to rob a train of an estimated $25,000. We decided on a date. The robbery would take place 2 weeks from the following Thursday. That would give us ample time to prepare everything. And every day on my lunch hour, we would go over our plans, step by step.
Now, the baggage car is in between the regular car and the mail car. There are two guards in the mail car, one man in the baggage car. Now, once we get past the man in the baggage car, our problem is solved. But timing is the most important thing, Cousin Walter.
Absolutely. I realize that, Eugene. It must be timed to the split second.
As you see, it takes 10 minutes to get to the junction where the man in the automobile should be waiting.
10 minutes, right.
The emergency cord should be pulled about 30 seconds before the junction is reached. No sense to upset the passengers.
Uh-huh.
Now, what about your job, Cousin Walter? Will they let you take a week off?
Oh, I'm sure they will. Sure, they'll let me off. But I'm still worried about Bess, Eugene.
Oh, now don't you worry about her. I'll talk to Bess. You just leave her to me. I'll talk to her.
And he did. He wove Bess around his finger as if she'd been putty. By the time he was through with her, she was begging me to take a week off and go somewhere. We'll find the money to pay for the trip somewhere, she said. But when Eugene suggested he'd finance the trip, that was the clincher. He told Bess he was going to take me up to the Hillary Lodge at Lake Tahoe for some fishing. Only he didn't finance the trip, I did. With the $178 I drew out of our savings account at the bank. We needed money for our hotel room in Reno, the train ticket we had to buy, and for the gun we needed. The rest of the week went fast. And then it was Friday night, and we were ready to leave. Eugene was waiting out in my car while I was finishing packing.
Oh, Walter.
Now, look, Bess, it's only for a week.
I know, but... Well, here, Walter, here are your other two shirts. You want to look nice and neat. Here, put them in the suitcase.
Fine. There. Well, I guess I'm all set. I'd better hurry.
Walter, you will take care of yourself.
Oh, of course I will, Bess. Now, don't you worry. I'll be all right. Well, all set, Eugene.
Oh, good.
Oh, Eugene.
Yes, Cousin Bess?
You take care of my Walter. Where'd you say you were staying?
The Hillary Lodge. It's near the lake.
Oh. Oh, Walter.
Now, look, Bess. If I don't write, please don't get worried. Promise me?
Yes, I promise.
Well, goodbye, dear.
Goodbye, Walter. Jean, take care, and have a good time.
Bye.
Well, we're on our way, Eugene.
Yep.
You know, the next time I drive down this street, I'll be a rich man.
Yep.
People like Bess are wrong, Eugene.
Wrong?
Yeah. Who says dreams don't come true? Cousin Eugene and I arrived in Reno, Nevada, late Friday night. When we got to Reno, we registered in one of the nicer hotels and stayed there for most of the following 3 days, just going out for our meals. On Monday, we left Reno for a short while and drove to the junction about 13 miles from Soda Springs. Eugene pointed out all the landmarks. This was where the train was to be stopped by pulling the emergency cord. Then on Tuesday, we went down to the train station and bought a ticket for the train leaving Thursday morning. On the way back to our hotel, we stopped in at one of the gambling casinos on the main street, and Eugene started putting nickels in the slot machine. Hey, Eugene, I surely hope you don't throw away your share of the money on things like this.
No need to worry about that, Cousin Walter. I'm for chickens. Well, day after tomorrow is the day.
Yeah, day after tomorrow.
How do you feel, Cousin Walter?
Well, excited. I don't know how to thank you, Eugene.
Oh, now there's no need for that.
And you're to be commended, too. Your plan is foolproof. Of course, I've never handled a gun before, but don't worry about that.
Did you say gun, Cousin Walter?
Well, yes.
Oh, I'm afraid you won't be handling the gun. I will.
Well, you'll be driving the car. You won't have need for a gun, Eugene.
But the positions are just reversed. I'll be on the train and you'll be in the car.
Me in the car?
I'm sorry, Cousin.
Wait a minute. Eugene, you've missed the most important part of our plan.
Huh?
This could very well cause it to fail.
Well, what are you talking about?
Identification. Our descriptions. Eugene, look at me.
What?
Look at me. Uh-huh. All right, now describe me.
Well,
go ahead, describe me. Look at me and describe me.
Well?
Go ahead.
Well, you've got sandy hair.
That's right. And so have 2 million other men. Go ahead.
And? Well, you're just sort of plain looking.
Exactly, Eugene. Exactly. Plain looking. Now, don't you see? When the guards on the train try to describe me to the authorities, they'll have a very difficult time. I certainly have no prominent marks or features to single me out from any other plain, sandy-haired man of 42 years, have I?
You know, Cousin Walter, I believe you've brought up a very important point.
Thank you, Eugene. So, I'll handle the gun and you'll drive the car.
Well, you don't think for 1 minute
that you're a coward? No, of course not. Wait a minute, Eugene. Let me pull the lever this time.
All right. You know about that?
You see, Cousin Eugene, we hit the jackpot. Our luck's already begun. We had dinner before we went back to the hotel. When we got back, Cousin Eugene drew out a diagram and we went over the plans again. All I was to take from the mail car was one money bag. Eugene figured that each bag ought to contain about $25,000. And with one half of that, he figured he could start a pretty good-sized chicken farm. It was close to 9 o'clock when Eugene shook me awake. This was the day. My heart was already starting to beat faster. I took a shower and shaved and got dressed. I put on my last clean white shirt. At breakfast, we went over our plan for the final time. Then we checked out of our hotel, put the bags in the car, and drove down to the station.
Don't forget to put the money in your suitcase, Cousin Walter.
Yes.
Are you nervous?
Yeah, a little.
Don't fire the gun, whatever you do. We don't want anyone to get hurt.
Yes, I understand.
Good. Now, remember, you've only got 10 minutes to get back to the mail car and get the money. Ten minutes, that isn't very long. Be sure and keep your eye on your watch.
I will. Keep my eye on my watch.
Well, it's time.
Yes, it's time.
Yes.
I'd better get on.
Good luck, Cousin Walter.
Thank you, Eugene. Thank you. This was it. I found my seat and sat down. I was lucky. The seat was in the first car after the baggage car. I wouldn't have far to go. I could feel the perspiration running down my back. I was ruining my last clean white shirt. The 50 minutes before we got to Soda Springs seemed like 50 hours. Then we reached Soda Springs and the train slowed down. There were no passengers at the station, so the train didn't stop. It just slowed down. And then we were on our way again. My 10 minutes had begun. I made my way up to the baggage car, carrying the suitcase. The baggage man was reading a newspaper.
Yes, sir. What can I do for you?
I'd like to check this suitcase.
Ah, forgot to at the station, huh? All right, hand it over here. I'll give you a baggage check.
Thank you.
Feels empty. You sure you wanted a check?
I'd appreciate it if you'd put your hands up.
What is this?
In simple language, a train robbery. Now, let's just start walking that way.
That's the mail car, mister.
I know.
Hey, now look.
Now, just do as I tell you and no one will get hurt. Walk in front of me. Now, knock and yell for the guards to open the door to the mail car.
They won't open it for me.
Oh, yes, I think they will. Now, knock.
Okay, mister, it's your funeral. Hey, Red, open up. It's Harold.
What do you want, Harold? There's nothing.
Pardon me, but would you put up your hands?
What are you talking about?
You'll force me to shoot this man. I wouldn't want to do that.
What is this?
A train robbery. Now, I'd appreciate it very much if you gentlemen would back up against that wall. That's it. Thank you. I'll just remove these guns from your holsters. I dislike bloodshed. And I'm afraid you gentlemen might be tempted. There we are. Now, let's see. Oh, yes. Here they are.
You're making a big mistake, mister.
You sound just like my wife. Now, let's see. Cousin said take just one bag. Now, there's so many, I think I'll take two. One apiece. I might as well. One. Two.
How do you expect to get off the train, mister?
The emergency cord will take care of that. Now, I have one more favor to ask of you, sir. Kindly open this side door of the car.
He's going to jump. He's crazy.
No, not just yet. We have about 30 seconds to go. Now, the door, please. Open it. Ten seconds. Five, four, three, two, one.
Now!
All right, now remain standing in that corner, both of you. Read our license numbers from this distance.
Doesn't matter. I've got them covered up. Well, how'd it go?
Perfect, Eugene. Perfect. I will admit I had a few bad moments, I guess, but otherwise it was perfect. Look. Look under these dirty shirts.
What? Well, you took two bags. But I told you only to take one.
Yeah, I know, but I figured it'd be easier dividing it with two bags. We didn't even bother to stop for any sort of refreshments. We drove straight through to Sacramento. When we got there, Eugene thought we ought to separate, and we did. I hated to see Eugene go. I'd grown very fond of him in the short time we'd been in business together. But it was a separation that you might call a necessity. When I got back to Oakland, it was almost 4:30. A good time, I thought to myself. I'll have the whole weekend to rest up before I have to go back to work. The house looked the same as I drove up. Maybe now I'll have it painted, I thought to myself. There was a car parked in front of the house. It was probably another salesman. I took the suitcase with my share of the money in it from the back seat and walked up to the front door. I had a wonderful feeling inside.
Why, Walter! Walter, dear!
Hello, Bess.
Oh, Walter, where have you been?
Where have I been? Why, Bess, you know very well.
You look a mess, Walter, but I'm so glad to see you, dear.
Bess, what's wrong?
Oh, here, dear. Come on into the living room and sit down.
But, Bess, I don't understand why you're acting so hysterical. I don't.
Here, Walter, put down your suitcase.
Well, Bess, who are these?
Oh, these gentlemen are from the police station,
Mr.
Walter.
Mr. Beaumont.
The police station? Oh. Look, Bess, I think I'll go upstairs and get cleaned up a bit.
Oh, there's plenty of time for that later.
Well, Bess, I...
Now, you just tell me where you've been.
Yes, your wife has been worried about you.
Oh, well, look, Bess, I couldn't...
Yesterday, I read in the paper where two men had been drowned at Lake Tahoe. They didn't know who they were. When I tried calling the Hillary Lodge, they told me you and Eugene weren't even registered there.
Oh, I see.
And I just got worried sick, So I called the police station. Oh, Walter, put down that suitcase and tell us what happened.
Well, later, Bess, later.
Oh, look at you, Walter. Your clothes all wrinkled. Dirty shirt, Oh, you look a mess.
Well, Bess, I'm sorry you're worried about me like you did.
Well, I'm glad you're home. You won't be getting out of my sight again for a long time, I tell you that.
Mrs. Beaumont, we're very happy that your husband arrived home safely.
Oh, yes, I am too, officer. But look at the condition he's arrived in. Oh, I'll bet he doesn't even have a clean shirt for work Monday morning. Here, Walter, give me that suitcase.
No, wait, Bess.
I'll just get your dirty shirts out of this suitcase and get them in the washer.
Well, I guess you won't be needing us anymore, Mrs. Beaumont.
Bess, please. Please, Bess, don't open the suitcase. Bess, please.
Suspense. Presented by Autolite. Tonight's star, Mr. Fred McMurray. Next week, the story about a man who committed a murder and got away with it for quite a while. The story is called Public Defender. Our star, Mr. Robert Ryan. That's next week on Suspense. Suspense is produced by Elliot Lewis and was directed tonight by Norman MacDonald. Music was composed by Lucian Morwick and conducted by Lud Bluskin. Portions of the program were transcribed. The Great Train Robbery was written for Suspense by Richard George Petticini. In tonight's story, Joseph Kearns was heard as Eugene. Featured in the cast were Paula Winslow, Jerry Hausner, and Hi Averback.
Suspense on Tuned to Yesterday from April 13th, 1953 on CBS. Closing out an hour of crime with shows directed by Norman MacDonald. Be sure to be with us next time on Tuned to Yesterday for more great programs from radio's past. Until our next hour together, I'm Mark Levanier. Thanks for listening.